I'd like to talk with you about today. I'm calling the idea of community. You might perhaps better call it the meaning of community. What I'm trying to get at will really be to reflect on the conceptual foundations of community, or the conceptual foundations of community as such. Not, as I see it, my task today to try to talk about any particular community, but rather talk about the foundations of any and all, I should qualify it and say, human communities. The conceptual foundation of all human community, or that is, why is it that people choose to live in community? What is it that community does for people? Are there certain basic human needs, basic human characteristics? Is there something about being human which causes us or inclines us to live in community? Does living in community change us? Are we fulfilled living in community? Are certain basic needs met only in community that could not be met outside of community? So in order to talk about community on the level in which I propose that we talk about it, we need, of course, to talk or think about what it means to be human. We're talking about human communities. We're talking then about something which human beings do because they're human. That presumably has some kind of salutary result. Now, in order to understand what it is that causes us or inclines us to live in community, I'd like to begin with a little exercise. I think we can probably do it in about 5 minutes, kind of an experiment. I would like us to imagine what it would be like to be living utterly and completely outside of any form of community. That is to say, to be living in some sort of situation in which we are not socially organized. And by not being socially organized, that would mean, of course, that we don't have governments, right? But it would mean more than that, that we don't live in anything like a family. It would mean that we don't have laws. It would mean that we don't have clear social or communal or cultural traditions, and so on. That is to say, we would be living in what some thinkers have called a state of nature. Now, let me suggest that I don't think anybody today argues that human beings ever actually lived in a state of nature. That if by a state of nature we mean a state in which we're living completely apart from any form of community or society or culture or civilization or, you know, family or some kind of shared person-to-person organization. And that might be, you see, the case because we simply can't. What it means to be a human being partly is to live together in some form of community. But for the sake of trying to understand what it is that community can and does give to us, let's try to imagine then this hypothetical state where we are living utterly outside of any form of community. Now for the exercise, I would like you to think, just for a few minutes, what would this be like? I mean, imagine a scenario in which we are outside of community. How would we live? What would we do? How would we react to other people? I mean, you might imagine, I suppose, that one you know, living outside of community, lives an utterly solitary life in a cave or something, but from time to time you might see another person, or another person might come your way. You have no social or communal relationship to that person. Well, what happens, you know, when that confrontation inevitably occurs? Okay? So step one then is to try and imagine what it would be like to live utterly outside of any form of social organization, in what we'll call, for lack of a better name, living in the state of nature, just natural man there, not socialized, civilized at all. And then when you've thought what it would be like to live in such a state of nature, then what is it that you're missing? I mean, what is it that you would want? Or is there anything that you would, you see as making life better, or potentially better, if you were to come into community? The question then becomes, what is it that we, as natural human beings, would need or desire? And I don't think for purposes of this exercise it's necessary to try to distinguish between needs and desires. But what is it that we would either need or desire, or both, that we might find available to us if and only if we were to come together as a human community? Okay? Now, I'd like you to do this in a maximum of about 5 minutes, and I'd like you to do it in about three groups. You can just separate now. Are there any questions about what I'd like you to do before you spend 5 minutes doing it? Okay? So two tasks. What's it like to live in this so-called state of nature, and then what do you want or need when you're there? I should have asked each of you to go off completely by yourself, you see, to think this through, but I was afraid that might not be able to reassemble you. I don't have enough confidence in my... Well, okay. I don't know if any dominant themes were sounded in trying to listen in on the three groups. I heard some of the same words coming from the three groups, but I didn't listen carefully enough to know if you were thinking about things very much alike or not. So I think that without asking for representatives or reports, I'll just maybe ask if there's somebody from this side of the room and somebody from there and somebody from there who would just kind of say what, at least in their understanding of what your particular group talked about, what seems to stand out as the most important or clear characteristics of life outside of community. Yeah? In other words, what did you stumble on or think about that made life outside of community clearly different from our life in various kinds of communities? Somebody from this? You have a word or a sentence? Or?
No, we went through boring twice.
You went through what?
The concept of the things being kind of boring.
Being boring?
We need the input of other people. For the things that we do, we depend on the input of other people.
Mm-hmm.
Other people's ideas.
Mm-hmm. Boring, to be bored, I think of being bored when there's nothing to do. When I'm not busy. But maybe you were thinking about boredom in a different way, because surely you would be pretty busy just attending to your basic physical needs, wouldn't you?
That would be it, though.
Just that would be
survival
it.
Survival kind of activities.
Mm-hmm. So that what you're suggesting then is that life outside of community would be really preoccupied with the basic questions of survival. Huh? And from early in the morning until late at night, you would be busy just doing what's necessary to keep yourself warm, keep yourself fed, and that you wouldn't have time to perhaps reflect on the meaning of it all. You wouldn't have time for poetry, music, stories, maybe. Is that? Yeah? Anybody else from this side of the room want to say something about? Yeah. How about somebody from the center? What kinds of thoughts did you have? You're not, when you speak, you're not reporting officially for your group. Don't feel that kind of burden. Just did something perhaps occur in your own mind that stood out? Yeah. How about?
Well, we talked at the end about how you and Tammy pass knowledge. If you're all by yourself, you have to learn everything for yourself. You wouldn't have any knowledge passed on.
Uh-huh.
That'd be kind of hard.
Mm-hmm. So that you would have to learn every technique that was necessary for survival. Again, yeah.
I think that you become somewhat hardened inside because you don't have anyone to share your joys or your daily things that you go through with. So you'd be sort of isolated within yourself. And
there would be no reason or cause for any form of celebration.
Yeah.
Or Thanksgiving, even.
Mm-hmm.
You would be completely dependent on yourself, it would seem, at least. Hmm? And that would be an unending task that would never be finished, which would...
It doesn't seem very fulfilling.
Uh-huh.
It's interesting to think of whether you'd even know how to laugh or cry.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think you would or wouldn't?
I don't know. I guess maybe if you hurt yourself, then you cry and think of you. I don't know.
And babies cry.
Yeah.
The babies cry, though, maybe because they sense that there's somebody or something that may respond. And would a baby keep crying for very long? If there never was any response, you know? I mean, perhaps the baby would cry immediately upon birth, and then, you see, if there was never any kind of affectionate or any kind of response, I wonder. It's a hard question, of course, because...
The baby would die and survive.
Yeah, this is why I was going to say it's a hard question to imagine even how survival would be possible without some sort of at least primitive society. And so when we're imagining what it would be like in a state of nature utterly apart from society, we're imagining something which, of course, historically couldn't have been since we're here. How about this?
Imagine the mother staying with the children for, you know, until they were at least physically to take care of themselves, like an animal.
Mm-hmm.
In this kind of situation where we necessarily have like the parental care, you said no families. Is that correct? You know, we have the family structure.
One would have to imagine a parent, probably the mother, meeting the minimal physical needs and then turning the child loose to fend for himself or herself. And when those minimum physical needs would be met, I'm not sure I can say that, but the notion is that, you know, the sort of extra physical care that a parent gives would be absent from this kind of situation. Okay, well, just how about somebody from this group? Was there a dominant theme over here? I mean, we've talked about it, life being just really hard. Without any of the reasons for celebration or thankfulness or, happiness or sadness, just sort of going on.
We finally went back to the original creationist, Adam.
Uh-huh.
Could not function without somebody to help him. He was unfulfilled. The capacity to love is in you. Given from God, he needed somebody to love, consequently he needed me.
Yeah, I mean, the point,
and
I think...
respond accordingly, and if you don't have that, you die.
Yeah.
A baby dies, an animal dies, if there is no one to respond to them.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would eventually is going to come to this. The idea of conceiving human life outside of some form of community is practically impossible. We can't even live. I mean, our need for others is so deeply rooted in what we are, you see, that the idea that we can be independent, self-sufficient, outside of community, that very idea tends to stand in violation with the very idea of what it means to be human. And the creation story, I think, makes that in one way very clear. Well, another thing I asked you to think about was what would it be like in this now admittedly untenable hypothetical state of nature? What would it be like when a person living that way were to have a chance confrontation with someone else? Now, let's assume, let me create a little scenario. Let's assume that somehow you've made it and you're living in a cave, and you're living in a cave in a fairly temperate climate, and you've got a small orchard, and perhaps you've cultivated some vegetables and domesticated some animals. And they're yours, and you take care of yourself. Now you keep very, very busy, I mean, working, doing this agricultural labor from early in the morning until late at night. There's no rest, you see. And you have to do everything. Harvest, you have to make your own clothes, you have to just do everything. But you're living that way. You know? Not a very human existence, agreed. But there you are. And somebody else, perhaps a more nomadic type, someone who's survived nomadically, comes along. And now you confront each other. What do you think it's going to be like?
I don't know. I can see a rather bitter conflict, because living alone, you've not experienced giving of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You could be a very selfish individual. You know, you're working for your own existence.
You're working very hard for your own.
Not to share with anybody else.
Yeah. And that's your... And so... but what do you... Now, that's... the attitude of the established agrarian person. What's the attitude of the nomad as he comes upon, I mean, here it is. Hey? What happens?
You have the same thing with the animals, though, because that's yours first. Even if you watch the hummingbirds up there, they got four feeders, and boy, that's a pecking order. You don't even, they could share three, but they don't want them. And all animals are like that. First, they're going to fight. And you have to sneak your way in if you want them.
There's going to be a fight, isn't
right.
there? I mean, I think it's mine because I planted it, or I think it's mine because I need it, or I think it's mine because I'm here, and this man coming along, I need it, it's mine, I'm here, it's mine, and I'm willing to do what's necessary to get it, you know? So I go in and I start picking the apples, and you see me, and you say, you know, in our society, you ask first. No. You say, well, there's laws against that. No. See, you fight over the apples, right? Or whatever. So, isn't it the case that living in the state of nature, as well as being dreary, maybe that's what your group meant as much by boredom as dreary, is going to be very insecure, isn't it? And you're constantly going to be threatened. Yeah. Okay, anything else that would characterize it, or any other reflections on it that anyone wants to mention?
We had a little bit of a debate over here about whether that person could learn love at all through nature, or through, well, of course we know the Bible says you can gain a conception of God from His creation, but we kind of unsettled about whether a person would really learn love at all.
Yeah, and one can also raise the question about whether or not one would acquire a conception of God if one insisted on constantly rejecting other human beings. Mm-hmm. And perhaps we will understand love and creation and ourselves only when we make an effort to be together. And maybe that's part of the of the discovery. Okay, now I want to make a suggestion or a proposal about what would get us out of this state of nature, and ask you whether or not after this change is made, whether or not there is still something that may be lacking. Now, supposing we simply agree as individuals in the state of nature that life is too hard, that we're going to be able to take care of our physical, biological needs much more adequately if we share the labor. And I'll grow the apples and you raise the chickens. And then I'll give you some apples and you'll give me some eggs or whatever. And supposing furthermore we recognize that life is going to be a lot more secure if we are willing to give up some of our, call them, natural rights. That is a natural right in the sense I'm using. It would be simply whatever you can get in the state of nature, whatever you have the power or strength to get, so that, you see, you have a right to those apples in the state of nature as long as you're able to get them. And if I'm stronger than you, then I have a right to them, but if you're stronger than I am, then you have a right to them. Okay? Well, let's suppose we decide that life is going to be more secure if we give up some of our natural rights, that we form a kind of commonwealth and say that things have to be ordered according to common principles or laws or something like that. That is to say, supposing we organize a society based on common assent, and this society will take care of our physical needs, food, shelter, clothing, and so on. So that the kinds of things that you've said most obviously were lacking are going to no longer be lacking. And supposing in order to do this, we develop what's ever necessary in the way of communication. I mean, we now have developed a language that is sufficient to the task, and so on and so forth. Perhaps the technology that can only be developed in society is now developed, and so on. Okay, so that trade is possible, and all of the activities of economics can be taken care of. So that we live now on the level of an economic society. At that point, are we missing anything? Do you see the conception that I'm trying? In other words, the main things, or the first things, or the most obvious things, or the most threatening things that we saw in life in the state of nature now are going to be remedied, and we have a kind of economic society. Yeah?
Yeah, you just said you gave up your right to nature. You gave up rights to accept this community. How much can a person give up before he feels the same way he felt without any people around him? I mean, you got to give up some right
One gives up the 10, rights.
10,000 acres or whatever, you're roaming your territory. Yeah. You got to give up some of that territory to accept other people in it.
One gives up the rights, but with a return. And what's returned is a kind of security. I mean, what's returned then is a more effective means for supplying your basic economic needs, so the fear of going hungry, for example, or the fear of freezing to death and so on, are greatly reduced. And you have also traded these natural rights for some kind of social protective system. So that when somebody, you know, is going to invade that which is still yours, your orchard, there now is a method of recourse, law perhaps backed by the enforcement of the sovereign or something like that. Okay? So that you've certainly given up something, but as I've tried to imagine it here at least, there's a trade. And you're getting back something. You're getting back what it was that we've mentioned we were missing most in the state of nature.
Yeah, but as the community grows, gets mm-hmm. larger and larger, you must give up more rights, or give up more territory, and more territory, and more territory to the community as the community gets larger. Mm-hmm. At what point can the person not give up any more rights, or give up any more self-respect? Must that person rebel against the community?
Yeah, you're imagining now a progression from society as I've described it to what we might call mass society. And it seems to me that that's a very serious issue. And, you know, sociologists have talked about the dehumanizing effect of mass society and mass mentality and so on and so forth. And when everything, you know, is taken away from you and you just become a little cog in a big machine, boy, at that point there's some serious questions about whether or not we're more or less human by virtue of our membership in society than we were in the state of nature. But let's defer consideration about that, and let's just imagine that this society works reasonably well and it's not escalating to a mass society. And let's say that, you know, peace and security and economic well-being are ours, that this society has succeeded, and perhaps this society that I'm imagining has succeeded better than any society in history ever did or would. Okay, but let's just imagine that society working to meet these kinds of physical, economic, bodily needs, so that our motive for doing something more isn't to, you know, have that any better, or to, you know, get back to another state where perhaps our economic well-being was better, but there's the question is there something else which is fundamentally non-economic, which we would be missing in this peaceful, nicely ordered, successful society? You know, the Greek word from which we get our word economics really meant home economics as well as economics. So all of the matters, you know, sort of household management and those kinds of things are just really taken care of in this primitive society, I'm imagining. Yeah?
Well, like Linda said before, you know, we can be with people and we still have to have some emotional needs, and we still have to have some sense of worth as an individual. We can live with a bunch of people and have protection and economic security, but we still need some kind of fulfillment of personal needs, mm-hmm. emotional needs.
Mm-hmm. Now, can you, or any of you, try to be a little bit more specific about what that fulfillment would be like?
I think the goal of spiritual life, regardless of Marx, you've got a Marxist society or a perfectly working economic society. That's what the point we are now.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's a Marxist society. It's just...
Well, we'll say that, but well, I mean, this is what Marx was arguing he could get. It's a perfectly working economic society. For all, you know, all we're getting these physical needs met.
Yeah, okay.
But we still have the spiritual fulfillment.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing in that strictly economic society that gives that exercise.
Mm-hmm. Now, what is this spiritual dimension like? How do we realize it? Is there any sense in which we want to have another kind of community, you see, a community which is differently constituted and meets different kinds of needs than this society, we'll call it, that would allow for the fulfillment of spiritual needs? I think the term spiritual need is one that means, it's a fairly broad term, and I don't want to suggest that there's any kind of community which would fulfill all spiritual needs or all of the things that any one of us might have in mind when we think of spiritual needs. But is there any sense in which we can think of community now, not society, as aiming toward the fulfillment of something which we might call spiritual needs, or which we might call the real human needs. I mean, the needs which really separate us from animals. Now, we've talked, several of us have mentioned, you know, animal societies, or what seem to be animal societies, working out some kind of pecking order or territorial imperative, or at least some way of managing limited resources and limited space and not, you know, constantly coming to blows all the time. So in some sense, you could say that the primitive society that we've imagined is what we're able to do insofar as we are like animals. Now, is there any community which, you know, allows us to be what we can be as humans, that is, humans created, as the story says, in a way that some of us tried to figure out last week, in God's image? Yeah.
Well, I would think once the economic needs are met, that people would start to, like, write poetry or beginnings of music and art forms and means of self-expression.
Mm-hmm.
If our needs were met corporately, then we have more time. They would be able to be done more efficiently too.
Yeah, one thing that happens when society seems to work, and this would be true whether you're talking about a Marxist society or a non-Marxist society, is that there suddenly appears a real luxury, leisure. We sometimes forget that the Greek word for leisure is skole, which you get school from. And I mention that as a kind of hint, because much of what goes on in school, which is not simply training in techniques for survival, is something which tries to humanize us or civilize us. Now, what is that? Yeah.
It begins with communication, I think, of varying sorts, verbal and the refinement of that, as well as nonverbal actions and music and stuff.
Mm-hmm. What is it that we would be trying to communicate in this primitive society? Some form of communication has got to be possible. Imagine working together to build a shelter. I mean, I take it that in any kind of primitive society, there's going to be some sort of division of labor and cooperation in building shelter and so on and so forth. And in doing that, you're going to have to, if you're up on the roof putting on the shingles, you're probably going to ask, you know, somebody else to bring the shingles up, and you're going to, you know, I mean, even if it's as primitive as sort of and pointing, kind of an ostensive form of communication, and there's that. But once these kinds of simple economic needs are fulfilled, and the communication, whatever level it is, of whatever degree of sophistication it is necessary to take care of that, I mean, I think you're suggesting that some higher form of communication is possible. Somebody mentioned poetry. I think, does poetry or music or art,
time for reflection.
Some sort of reflection made possible only when we have leisure?
Well, things that sort of express, like, who we think we are individually and who we think other people are individually, that sort of thing.
Words like I and we and they, those kinds of things are really necessary to get that with. Just kind of.
So that one thing that will happen is we will begin to try and understand ourselves. What does it mean? I mean, you're suggesting that even on a linguistic level, we'll begin to try to differentiate, you know, one person from another person, understand individual needs, but to understand individual needs will also be to understand common needs, to understand individual differences will also mean to understand what we have in common, and so on. so that we're going to begin to understand ourselves. Huh? Do we have any need for doing that? Does that humanize us? Is there something inherently worthwhile about this quest for self-understanding?
We spend a great deal of time trying to get people to understand us.
Or
really, well, you know, we're talking about expressing ideas or something, and I don't know who was saying, but you finally get down to the you know, you're trying to express something, and finally you have to find a common ground to both of you know to relate this somehow. What is inside of us?
Mm-hmm.
A way to share the way we're feeling, what we're thinking about, what our fears and what our desires are.
Let me ask then what I think is the question that a lot of you are touching on. You know, why is it that we want to tell our story to anybody else? As you put it, why, you know, we want to tell other people, you know, what we fear, what we like, what we're doing, where we're going.
We have to express our needs and how we relate to other people, whether we're dependent, independent, or interdependent as a group.
Now, what does all of this imply, that we want to do that? And I think that once, you know, basic economic physical needs are taken care of, we discover very quickly that we have a need to tell our story.
Well,
and, you know, the oldest societies, I mean, look at the Gilgamesh epic. That's a telling of a story of sort of a pilgrimage.
Of our understanding of the meaning of life and how we fit into it.
I mean, it really is one presupposing that there is a meaning of life that we can discover, and that in order to discover it, we have to talk together, or we have to be together, you know, and talking perhaps is the wrong word, perhaps communicating is a better word, because it's not simply talk. I mean, it has to do with all forms of human expression, whether it's the expression of painting a cave wall, or whether it's the expression of playing a flute, or whether it's the expression of doing a dance, or whether it's the expression of talk as we're doing now. Yeah, I think that you had something else? No?
Sometimes I think you share because you want to find out if that person is just like you, if they have the same kind of need you do.
Share your feelings and your thoughts. Yeah, I mean, now, we know, we have to be kind of careful here and make an important distinction. We know that we're all alike insofar as we all need to eat and sleep and keep warm and so on and so forth. So to say, I want to know whether you're like me, what is it I want to know when I want to know that?
You want to belong to what you can be part of. Belong to.
I want to belong to a group possibly because that will assure me that things which concern me are not simply my own, you know, peculiarities.
Part of your knowing yourself is to give it away to somebody else. And in that you have reassurance. That reaffirms you, that's who I am, because you've shared yourself with somebody else first.
Yeah.
Then you have an identity. But
yeah.
Not until you give away that away to someone.
Yeah, I think that we're all saying that, and I think that's right on the mark, that knowing yourself means knowing yourself in relationship with others, that there is to know oneself an implied communion with others. But the question is, you know, what are the concerns that we have now as humans which transcend our particular, I made a promise to myself, I wouldn't use words like that, transcend. let me start this over again. What are our needs as humans which go beyond our particular bodily needs? You see, I mean, I need so many, I think, cups of coffee every day, and others need less, but what are the needs which go beyond these particular circumstantial physical needs that we all, that are our, as it were, ultimate concerns?
If I hear what you're saying right, I think this was illustrated to my wife and I last summer. We visited Japan shortly, and we were with a group of Japanese housewives who our son happens to be teaching. And so we were asked a lot of questions, and you know, we were, it was a totally different culture, and that was our culture shock. But they said, could you tell us what you Americans have, what are you concerned about, you know, you as parents now? She said, I'll tell you what we're concerned about. We're concerned about making enough money for some sense of, we can see something down the road for a sense of retirement security, for buying a home, for, you know, getting enough to also end the education of our children. And they have a different economic system, kind of, when they're working in factories, and factories kind of take care of them. But we said, probably we're talking about the same things, you know, that these are some of the same concerns that there. So there was a sense.
Okay, but now, what I think you're saying would suggest to me that those are not the ultimate concerns, but those are rather the prerequisite concerns. In other words, we need, yeah, you see, to have a certain degree of security. We need to have a certain economic base, a certain amount of wealth. We need to have a certain degree of power. I mean, we need to be able to effectively act against the material world, which is a part of it. And those things are in order, you see. Then we have leisure. And when we are leisurely, then we are free to do just what concerns us. But until we get these other elements taken care of, we are slaves. And this is a Greek distinction, but I think it's a useful one. Insofar as we are just economic creatures, we are slaves to our bodies. But when we have taken care of these economic needs in whatever fashion, then suddenly we become free. And what I'm suggesting is that when we are genuinely free, that is, free from the demands that our bodies make, then we are able to together deal with what really concerns us. And what really ought to concern us, you see, isn't whether or not we're going to have a place to sleep that night, that kind of survival thing. See, we've gotten ourselves beyond the what we were calling before the state of nature. Yeah.
It seems to me that that's where the importance of knowing yourself and knowing others comes in, you know, because you can go beyond those essential needs, and that to make your little community or something more harmonious, it helps to know yourself and to know others and how they react to things and stuff. And so that it's important to not only work on understanding yourself, but to work on understanding the other person first and sort of create a cycle there of, you know, you can talk and say, but you don't understand, and, you know, that sometimes I think we have the feelings that no one really understands us or have experienced things exactly the same way we have or something, so that it's helpful to work on trying to understand the other person first, and then that sort of backtracks and puts you in that cycle of learning yourself. It's sort of a give and take thing.
And in learning both, what are we learning? I guess would be the, see, learning to know myself in relationship to others or together with others, and recognize the sense in which we have common purpose, common goals, common hopes. We begin to discover, you know, that which which makes life meaningful, or that which, you know, constitutes life at all. Or to use religious language, you see, in this communal discourse, we begin to understand God and our relationship with God. Yeah.
Carrying this out, then, as this develops over a period of a long time, within the larger community, then there would be forming little communities of musicians, artists, possibly communities of faith, those who see themselves in the same relationship and the meaning of life. And then there would be interaction between all those communities within them. I mean, wouldn't that would develop over a period of time?
Sure, I think it would. Can you just say why you think it would happen that way? Or should happen that way?
Well, someone said we find out who kind of thought the same. You know, people would tell the story to see, do you think the same way? Do you have the same idea that I have about the meaning of life and all? And so then there'd be, interaction going on, and we'd find another one and another one. And then they'd find someone who's different, and so they would go out, and they'd kind of break down into, it's like over a period of time it would develop that way.
Yeah, well, wouldn't it be something like this, that...
We still have to all fit into the whole.
Yeah, we could talk about it in terms of the increase in liberation from our particular, circumstances. That we're musicians, a group of us, and we understand the language of musicians, but when we begin to come together as musicians, we may believe that true beauty, or true happiness, or true purpose, or whatever, is completely and adequately captured in music. Now, a group of people are practitioners of another art and may also, because of their particular talents or circumstances, and may believe that completely or adequately. But in this kind of process of liberation in community, then one begins to recognize that what holds us together genuinely and what draws us genuinely is not the particular form, but rather is the truth, the beauty, the goodness, the meaning of it all in its most pure form. And so that in community, then there can be a kind of ascension or building up, you see, toward this, possible through the exploration of the various forms of human expression. So that in this sense, what community would teach, I guess, when Sister Ingeborg was here last week, somebody asked the question specifically about the role of the arts in her community at Grand Champ. Community in this sense would teach that, music is not an end in itself, or painting is not an end in itself, or poetry is not an end in itself, but rather they serve as particular forms to point to something universal. So that as we come together in community then, I'm suggesting, and the real justification for coming together in community, and the real reason why people do come together in community, is because we're on a kind of quest to discover what is universally, absolutely, ultimately true. Because that is what, in the deepest sense, defines us and makes us who we are, and frees us from the particular facts of our own worldly existence. My life has meaning now, not because, you see, I am a very good bricklayer, or because I am a lousy bricklayer, but because I am part of this family of man. We don't define ourselves then in community in terms of our particular skills or our particular fortunes or misfortunes or strengths or weaknesses, but all of that is cut through. And what's genuinely human then obtains apart from that. Now what I've been trying to suggest is that there are all sorts of attempts at community that have, you know, that have happened, that in some sense all attempts at community are trying to realize this universal. In many ways communities fail, but that usually when communities fail as communities, it's because they become too interested in a particular, and they lose sight of that universal which ought to cut through all particulars. And so that when communities fail, it's because they are something like mutual interest groups. And I read an essay before I came here by some of you maybe know the Catholic worker movement. Over in the library, I saw some copies of a little newspaper called the Catholic Worker, and it's a notion of community and of giving to less fortunate. It's a very, very, I think, inspiring movement, and I like to at least keep up with what they're doing. At any rate, in reading an essay in the Catholic Worker newspaper before I came here, there was a discussion of community, and the question was, what sort of community is marriage, and why is marriage sometimes successful and sometimes not? And the point that was being made, or at least one of the points that was being made, was that marriages very often fail when they are when they're nothing more than sort of a common interest association. You and I both like to collect stamps, and so we get married because we're stamp collectors together, you see. But there's nothing else that brings us together, and that's not a suitable basis for community or marriage or whatever, you see. But that marriage succeeds, community succeeds, when it recognizes that what it's grounded in, what gives its meaning, purpose, end, what gives its significance, you see, is this universal beyond. Now, let me just end with a little quick lesson in Greek. The Greeks called this kind of community the polis. The polis. The polis is the root of the... Polis is the root for the word we have for politics. Huh? The problem is that it's very often misunderstood. Let me make a kind of analogy to explain what the polis is, and by doing that, I think explain, and perhaps in another way, what this idea of community is. What is done by the polis is called politics. Now, we don't have the word polis in English. We do have the word politics, so we have trouble understanding that. So let's make an analogy. What is done by the athlete, that's a Greek word, is athletics. Now, athletics is inconceivable without the athlete, and the athlete is inconceivable without athletics, because the end, purpose, goal of the athlete and of athletics is the same. Okay? Same thing for the polis or the community. The end, purpose, goal of the community and all of the activities in the community, which make up the community, ought to be the same. So for the true community, in this sense then, the end, purpose, and goal of each member of the community is the same as the end, purpose, or goal of the community itself. So that even though each person in the community has a different task, it's not that the community is simply some sort of umbrella organization which provides a kind of basic security to allow you to be a stamp collector and you to be a bricklayer, but rather the true community is whatever it is that bricklaying and stamp collecting, you know, and sound taking and everything all have in common. And that's the universal which brings people together, defines humanity, and reveals, in some sense, I think, the ultimate concern of being human. Okay, let me just do an this week, starting tomorrow, I'm going to lead a discussion group in which we're going to look at parts of Kierkegaard's book called Works of Love. And this is a very lovely book to read and deals in many ways with the idea of what it means to be human and what it means to be human together with others. And Kierkegaard takes very seriously the admonition in the New Testament, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. And what does that mean in community? How does one love thyself in the same way that one loves one? There's a certain kind of tension and contradiction he tries to resolve. I think that from a specifically Christian standpoint, in other words, Kierkegaard deals in a way that's eloquent and edifying, deals with the same question of the meaning of community. So if any of you are interested, there are a few copies left in the bookstore, but even if you can't get a hold of a copy, we'll read just short portions out loud and talk about them, and I think